From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peek.
And I'm Lauren Strawn, sitting in for John Wells, who is at the Future in Review Conference in San Diego this year.
At 9,300 feet in a picturesque canyon above Crested Butte, Colorado, in the former silver mining turned ghost town of Gothic, is the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory. Now, scientists from all over the globe come each year to do research at this mountain outpost. And if there were a list of top 10 science tourist destinations, RMBL would be among the top. The director of the lab, Ian Billick, spoke to a group of about 65 people from Park City last month on City Tour. We thought we'd invite him on the show to talk about the research that goes on at Rumble since 1928, in fact. Billick is a field biologist who is interested in the ecology and the evolution of complex systems. He has a PhD in biology from the University of California at San Diego, and he lives in Crested Butte. Ian, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me today, Lynn.
Really nice to have you. I've never listened to someone who can weave together so many different themes of science and tie it together in such a way that you go, wow, it all makes sense.
Well, we love sharing the place. It's a really special place. It's beautiful, and it's got this wonderful science. And so it's always fun to share that with people.
Maybe you should define for me what a field station is, in that you attract researchers from all over the world who come and present what they want to do research on, and you either approve it or you just rent them space. How does the whole thing work?
We're essentially a research platform. A platform is something that scientists use to ask questions. A lot of science advances by developing new technology that allows us to see complicated things or small things in new ways. In this instance, Field Station is doing the same thing, but it isn't kind of bright and shiny. What we're doing is we're enabling scientists to get outdoors. We handle the permitting for them. It's not necessarily easy to work on federal land or get access to private land, so we manage that. There's a whole bunch of logistical support that they need to conduct their research. They may have equipment. They may need assistance with travel plans. And then probably the most interesting thing we do is we try to help them knit all of that historic research together to enable new discoveries. So by taking advantage of previous research, they can ask really fascinating questions that they couldn't in the absence of the accumulated knowledge about the ecosystem.
Along those lines, knitting the old and the new, I read on your website about your vision, your mission is really to work with data science and collaborative scientific exploration. Do you also support the scientists with various forms of data analytics or things like that?
We are just starting to do more interesting things around data analytics. One of the things that's happening in field science is what I call the spatial revolution, which is a combination of different technologies and ways of thinking about data that are all coming together. The data revolution kind of involves four components: the ability to know where you are, right? So if you're out with Strava and you're mountain biking, we know exactly where you are if you've got your beacon on. We have wonderful ways of collecting information about the environment. So there's technology that allows us to look at visible and non-visible spectra. We can measure snow and the density of snow in crazy ways. The third part of the revolution is the way we deploy that. So there's drone technology, which really only popped up on the scene a couple years ago. And then people are doing amazing things with satellites. Google's got their low-cost, low-orbit satellites out there. And then the fourth part of the revolution is analyzing the data. And as everybody probably hears, we're in the the world of big data. And so field scientists are using machine learning techniques to understand that. So we can generate massive amounts of data, but the challenge then is how do you actually use that data? So that's one of the things that we've been starting to do is providing spatial data products to scientists that would be difficult for them to invent on their or come up with on their own.
And a quick follow-up, so are you able to use those products to go back into your decades of research, back to 1928, and piece and parse out interesting information that maybe wasn't obvious or available at the time just because we didn't have these data analytic tools?
Yeah, absolutely. We have what I call the spatial toolbox, which is how do we help scientists think about questions on the right spatial scales? And then the temporal toolbox, if we're interested in how the world's changing, and with climate change, how do birds, hummingbirds, butterflies respond to that change, we need a temporal toolbox. And so the exciting thing about Rumble is we've got perhaps the world's largest collection of long-term studies. So we've got this amazing long-term temporal toolbox. By putting that together with the spatial toolbox, we can just ask questions that, you know, are almost mind-boggling. By bringing those things together.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Ian Billick. He is the director of the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory, located high up in the mountains, 9,300 feet above Crested Butte. Ian, I'm picturing the place, and I wish our listeners could all picture it along with me. You basically took these old run-down structures, not you personally, but back in the beginning in 1928, hopefully that was before your time, and you've kind of reclaimed them and renovated them. You've added a few buildings of your own. Can you describe this place? And again, it is really a tourist destination. You get people coming just to see what you do in the lab.
Yeah, where we are is an abandoned mining town. It was fascinating for me, you know, as I sort of learned history, to realize that huge parts of the country were undiscovered even after the Transcontinental Railroad linked the West Coast and the East Coast. And the Hayden Survey was one of the four big surveys in the western U.S., and it was the one that came through this area in 1873. And what they were doing was documenting the geology, looking at the plants and animals. Economic botany was very important in the 1800s. And then that led to a silver boom. The mineral of interest in our neck of the woods was silver. We're not too far from Aspen. Gothic just exploded in 1879. So there are newspaper reports that there were 8,000 people living there. And if you showed up today and you looked at the cabins and realized how high we were, you would scratch your head and say, how could they squeeze 8,000 people in? But that mining boom was short-lived. The value of silver was plummeting in the 1880s and early 1890s. So by 1890s, what was left was a mining town with abandoned buildings. Every year, we got on average about 450 inches of snow. The buildings weren't necessarily built well, so very quickly they started to deteriorate. A few, just by chance, were built in a way that they persisted. So when the scientists were looking for a place to start a field station in 1928, they didn't have a lot of money to start. They moved into these old buildings up in the subalpine ecosystem surrounded by the mountains.
Wow. You have a lot in common with Park City. We're not quite as high as you are. We probably don't get that much snow per year, but we do have a silver mining past. We also have a proliferation of yellow-bellied marmots. And at Rumble, you have studied yellow-bellied marmots since 1962. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'd say it's a little bit like the Old Testament. This marmot begat this marmot, so on, so on for generations. The scientists originally, Ken Armitage from the University of Kansas, started working on marmots up at Yellowstone, and a friend of his, Paul Ehrlich, who wrote the population bomb and was kind of a well-known scientist, said, hey, why don't you come to Gothic, because there are marmots everywhere. and the marmots were living under the cabins. And so Ken moved his research on the population biology of these marmots to Gothic. And he was a very successful physiological ecologist, meaning he was interested in how these marmots could survive up at high elevation. So he was able to keep that research going himself into the late 90s, early 2000s. And then we had the good fortune that it was such a rich data set that Dan Bloomstein at UCLA, once Ken retired, decided to continue that project. And so they've maintained the mark recapture, so they'll capture the marmots, and I say they're like kind of kids of modern day where they put the ear tags on, kind of like the earrings, and then they've got the tattoos, they dye them, so if they're looking at them through binoculars from a distance, they know who's who. They've continued that mark recapture study, and then they do a whole bunch of behavioral work on top of that, and then as new technology emerges, they can apply that. So they have a genome, so they've sequenced the genome of the yellow-bellied marmot, they can do protein studies, and they can do this research within the context of a mark recapture study going back to 61, having basic information and knowing some about the genealogy and genetics.
So we have a also expanding population of marmots here in Park City, particularly over by our grocery store we call Dan's. And I'm wondering if some of the similar reasons that the population is exploding there in Crested Butte is probably what's going on here as well. The earlier coming out of hibernation, growth of more and more, you know, food sources. Can you describe, just in brief, the Nature article that your scientists published on this fact?
Yeah, we... Because they've been watching the marmots for so long, they're able to see long-term trends. And one of the challenges in environmental biology is that the world's always changing, but we may not have context for that change. There's been a lot of concern about the decline of bees. Is that sort of a fundamentally new thing, or is that just part of a natural cycle? So the advantage of the marmot study is because the data goes back about back so long, they can put these changes within the context of the long-term information, and they can also start getting at what are the actual drivers. Why is it that they're changing, not just documenting that the change is happening. And our ability to predict and understand is really driven by our understanding of why the changes are happening. And what we've seen is that the snow, that the marmots are emerging almost 40 days earlier than they were 50 years ago. And they have a longer growing season, so they've been able to put on more weight, and that's increased their survivorship. So that's led to larger population sizes, healthier marmots. And then they've linked that to these long-term changes in snowpack and temperature.
Got it. I think one thing you said that was really interesting just then was about putting things in context. And as I was looking over the Rumble website and into some of the research there, I stumbled across the Rumble plot of land that's been going for 28 years now, I think, where you have some heaters and you've warmed the land up 4 or 5 degrees, I believe. Could you tell us a little bit about this experiment?
Yeah, this experiment was set up not long after the first congressional hearings on climate change. Tim Wirth was in Congress, and he also happened to be on Rumble's board at the time. So in the late 80s, that was when Congress really started grappling with the reality of climate change. And as people started thinking about climate change back then, one of the big questions around the uncertainty for what our world will look like has to do with feedback effects. And I say feedback effect, it's like I walk into a bar and I hit you, you hit me, my friend hits you, your friend hits my friend, and it spirals out of control. That's a positive feedback effect. The negative feedback is our friends grab us and pull us apart. So the question in climate change is, if we release fossil fuels and that warms the atmosphere, what happens to the carbon that's stored in the oceans and in the soil. So about one-third of carbon is in the soil, and if making the temperature warmer meant that more plants grew, that would be a negative feedback effect because they would be pulling carbon out of the atmosphere and reducing what's going on with climate change. If you warm things up and the microbes in the soil start breaking down the carbon in the soil and releasing it into the atmosphere, that's a positive feedback effect, meaning that we would expect more rapid warming across the world. So this experiment was set up to look at the extent to which we have positive and negative feedback effects. And now there are examples of this experiment run around the world, but this was the first one. And when we took it down this summer, we don't have the results yet, but what they're going to do is they're going to look at the deep soil, what's gone on with carbon, to understand carbon budget and improve predictions for future climate change.
So how does the plot physically look different? Like, does it look different than the land around it?
Yeah, so the interesting thing about a long-term experiment is that there are a couple different types of questions you can ask. One is, if you watch the same plots for 30 years, do you see changes that you would expect relative to climate change? And then the second is some of the plots are warmed and some of them aren't, and so that you can compare the heated plots to the control plots. And when they compare the heated plots to the control plots, what they see is an increase in woody sagebrush, which is a plant found down at lower elevations, and a decline in the showy wildflowers. And that's interesting because the sagebrush is a slow-growing plant species. It means it doesn't take as much carbon out of the atmosphere. On the other hand, sage doesn't release carbon, so that if you've ever smelled sage, if you're hiking or mountain biking and you have that strong aromatic smell when you break the branches of a sage, those are terpenes that make it difficult for microbes to release that carbon. So there's been an increase in carbon, or an increase in the sagebrush, a decline in the wildflowers, and that does have an impact on carbon budget.
And it may have an impact as well on that decline of bees, which I guess, how much research is done on bees at Rumble?
A lot. About one-third of the calories that humans eat come from plants, which are pollinated by insects and animals. A lot of what we know about pollination comes from RMBL. One of the reasons is that there's so much research is because we don't have the introduced honeybees. So the honeybees, when people think of honey and the big colonies and the beekeepers, those were bees that were brought over to the United States from Europe and Asia in the 16 and 1700s. Those bees don't do very well at high elevation because they can't store enough food to make it through winter. So scientists that are interested in natural pollination systems, so what are the native bees doing and how do they interact with these plants that they've been evolving with for tens of thousands of years, this has become a great place for them to come and do that research. And then as more research gets done, it just attracts more and more people, a little bit like Silicon Valley, where you get this sort of virtuous cycle. So there's quite a bit of research on bees.
Yeah. Well, as you say that, there are distinct advantages to being at that altitude to do certain types of research. What are the other relative advantages and disadvantages of being at 9,300 feet and doing scientific research?
Well, scientists, even though we don't always act like it, we're normal people. And so scientists like to mountain bike and be in beautiful places. And so they're, you know, it's a strong draw. It's such a short growing season. It fits the academic schedule well, right? And so if classes at a college end in mid-May, they can relax for a couple weeks, and then Gothic is melting out in late May or early June. And because the growing season is so short, by mid-August, a lot of times things are sort of slowing up, shutting down. So one of the reasons people have come in the past is because, one, it's just a great place to be. just to recreate and enjoy, and two, it really fit people's personal schedules. The kids have to get to school, they have to teach, that kind of thing. So those have been the original draws. Now more and more we see that people want to take advantage of the long-term marmot data or all of this research on pollination. So we're starting to see more people come in to take advantage of those long-term data sets.
So in addition to scientists, Lynn mentioned that a lot of tourists come by as well. And I saw on your website that you can get the iNaturalist app downloaded onto your phone. Could you explain a little bit about that app?
There's a lot of interest in citizen science. Sometimes we think about science as being, you know, an older white male who stands in front of a room and imparts his wisdom. The reality is that scientists come in all genders and colors and all ages, and we want people, even though they're not PhD scientists, to have opportunities to engage in that. And so citizen science is a way for just people who want to look at the world more closely and join in the process to participate. And iNaturalist is one of the great tools for citizen science. And you can do this there in Park City. This is an app that's available and can be used around the world. You download it and you can take photographs, and they've developed machine learning tools which will give you a potential identification. And then depending upon what part of the world you're in, an expert may get on and confirm the identification of the plant species. And for people who use iNaturalist in the Gothic vicinity, we have a wonderful curator of our herbarium, Rick Williams, and he is active during the summer with iNaturalist and will get on and confirm identifications of plants. I'd say it's a little bit like social networking Facebook for botanists and science geeks.
I think that's fantastic. I have to admit, I'm slightly jealous as a scientist here in Park City. I really wish all the Strava users would be as addicted to iNaturalist as they are to their Strava account. And it would be neat to see an app that linked the two. You know, great, you made it to the top of Scott's. Now take a picture of the flowers, please. You know, it's reminded you. The app reminded you.
That's a great idea. Many apps link.
Right, right. Ian, one last thing that I wanted to ask you about is your youth summer camps. That sounds like something that would be really popular there and here. How many kids do you guys host each summer?
We have about 1,500 contact days with children. During the summer, we run daily programs, Monday through Friday, starts with age 4. And people can bring them for one day, they can bring them for 4 or 5 days in 1 week, they can bring them one day a week, just sort of depending upon what their schedule is. We have a middle school program that goes for a week in July, where middle school students will come out and kind of take a technology engineering intensive class. And then at the end of July and the first week of August, we have a 2-week high school field biology course. So it's kind of like a precursor intro college-level course for students that want to get introduced to field science. And they take classes for 2 weeks straight, 8 hours a day. They get introduced to a lot of the science. They get an opportunity to conduct their own research project. And then we're also building out programs for all age groups where we support schools throughout the school year. So we're moving towards hosting school programs and providing curriculum and content for people in classrooms across the country.
Mm. What about for the 50-year-old who did humanities in college and really wishes they could do it all over again and become a scientist? What do you have for that person?
Yeah, so we do K through grade. It's June through September, we have a visitor center. And we do twice daily tours that are free. It's a chance to come in and walk around and see the place and ask questions. The visitor center is open from 9 to 5, and there's staff that are there answering questions, not doing the tours. The tours are during scheduled times, but people can come in and ask questions about the science. And then on Thursday mornings during the summer, we do paid tours where we send visitors out with scientists and let them have a deep dive into the warming experiment or the hummingbird research and learn, interact with the scientists and learn more deeply about what the scientists are doing.
Nice. That's what I want to do when I grow up. I want to be one of your tour guides. I bet you have a waiting list a mile long for people who say, I'll just volunteer there all summer.
We do have a docents program, so people that want to volunteer and are able to spend a little more time in the area, they get a chance to take a deeper dive in understanding Rumble and how it works, and we train them up and give them opportunities to volunteer with scientists and help out with some of our remote locations, and then they are out greeting people and talking with them and giving them background. So when you're ready, we'll set you up on the docent program, Lynn.
Oh, very nice. Before we let you go, Ian, I just wanted to mention, you know, on City Tour from Park City, last year we went to Bozeman, and I don't know if you're familiar, it's kind of one step beyond the citizen scientists. It's called Adventure Scientists, where they have people who are, you know, climbing Mount Everest, actually, instead of taking pictures, maybe, they're gathering data in little baggies or test tubes or whatever and sending it back. Are you familiar with that program?
Yeah, and really when I was talking about how science is changing in the citizen science, it's changing in lots of fascinating ways that are hard to keep up with.
It really is.
There are scientists, you can access Strava data and use that to understand what's going on with elk herds. So the way that we've thought about who scientists are and how data is collected, it's just changing very rapidly, and it's creating lots of opportunities for people to engage in ways that they didn't realize they could.
It's such a cool world. I love it. And you are helping to foster and forward that world. So Ian Billick, the director of Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory, thanks so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me on, Lynn and Lauren. I really enjoy being here.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.